As wildfire seasons grow longer and more destructive, mountain and rural communities are searching for scalable, cost-effective solutions. This Peak Environment podcast explores how biochar can turn hazardous forest fuels into a climate solution, reducing wildfire risk, sequestering carbon, and creating the solution towards regenerative landscapes.
You're listening to Studio 809 Podcasts. This is what community sounds like.
Welcome to another episode of Peak Environment, a Studio 809 community podcast in the Pikes Peak region about environmental integrity and stewardship. Peak Environment is recorded at The Next Us, a professional cooperative environment for small businesses in downtown Colorado Springs. I'm your host today, Allie Richardson from Pikes Peak Permaculture. Pikes Peak Permaculture is a 501c3 educational nonprofit that's been serving Southern Colorado since 2002, teaching the nature and ways of permaculture design. To learn more about our programs, visit pikespeakpermaculture.org. And for more conversations like this one, explore other episodes of Peak Environment at studio809podcast.com. Today, I have a couple guests who will be discussing a couple of ways biochar is produced and how it benefits the forest, the health of the environment, and also offers community protection. Local large-scale industrial production is becoming more common, but small-scale production is happening all over the region too. So I'd like to introduce the few guests that I have today. I'll start with Will Vogel. He's a local firefighter of El Paso County, an owner and operator of Vogel Homestead Farm, which is a regenerative sheep ranch in Black Forest. Will is also a board member with the El Paso County Conservation District. Welcome, Will. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And I also have Douglas County Jared Tanaka. He's the environmental inspection supervisor for Douglas County, and he's responsible for market creation, among many other things, in the biochar realm. And he's been described as the heart and soul of the biochar project out of Douglas County. And I'm very excited to hear about the facility that you have up in Douglas County, and welcome, Jared.
Thank you for having me.
And lastly, I have Becky Elder with me. She's the executive director of Pikes Peak Permaculture, and she is also the local environmental guru of the region. And all things permaculture comes from Becky in this region for sure. Thank you for coming, Becky, again.
Good morning, Allie. Great to be here.
So we're talking about biochar today. It's not a new concept, it's not a new material. It's actually something that's been produced for over 2,000 years with origins in the Amazon basin of South America. They called this soil terra preta soils. And these lands were inoculated with a weathered charcoal through a process which revived the land. Let's start with you, Jared. Thank you for coming again. So you have a biochar facility that is, I guess, one of the first in the nation that's out of Douglas County?
I'll preface this slightly and say we do not have it yet. We are still in the planning permitting process. We have begun initial infrastructure work there. But, the facility is not up and running quite yet. We hope to be the second municipality, potentially the first in America, to run a commercially scaled biochar production facility. So, hopefully within the year, we will be first or second in the country on a municipal commercial scale. So, yes.
That's really great. We're really excited that Douglas County has made this jump to create this facility because we feel in permaculture that biochar offers such wonderful solutions in many avenues, whether it's fire mitigation or rehydrating the land and so many other things, which we can talk about in a little bit. Can you tell me why the idea first came to shape and who kind of championed the biochar facility?
The idea was born from the Wildfire Action Collaborative, which is a regional wildfire and emergency management association that was formed through Douglas County's work. And Commissioner Abe Layden was instrumental in pushing this narrative forward, this initiative, identifying outlets for liability biomass. Through that research came the inevitable conclusion that on a commercial scale, biochar is the way to rid the forests of this liability material. So that was kind of the birthplace of the idea.
That's really great. Thank you. And I want to jump over to you too, Will, because you're also on your landscape through what you had called a community risk reduction program. You're also doing some biochar production as well on a smaller scale.
Yeah, so we're kind of approaching it from two angles. So on my farm specifically, we run sheep in a lot of forested areas, and there's a heavy need for working on these forests to thin them out, get them to a healthier stage, improving those ecosystems that are surrounding those trees to a point where they used to be. A big problem we have here is our forests are just heavily overgrown. We're looking at probably an average of 500 to 2,000 trees per acre, when historically, especially for like Ponderosa and Doug Fir areas, we were looking at somewhere between 20 and 60 trees per acre. So we have had a lot of material that we have to remove to get that landscapes or those landscapes back into a healthy state. From the farm side, it means just going in and helping some of the clients that we work with the grazing side to mitigate their forests, and then that produces a lot of biomass, and some of that we can use for poles and firewood and mulch. But we're looking into the idea of having a smaller portable biochar kiln. It'd be like a flame cap style kiln where it's open on the top. And that would allow us to use slash and like pine needles and the branches and whatnot that are really low value. They're great for mulches, but there's when you're making mountains of mulch, you get to a point where you don't really need anymore. So it'd be nice for us to be able to take that material and turn it into something that we can actually use in other ways on our operation. On the other side, the agency I work for on the fire department side is also ramping up their community risk reduction program in our area, as far as trying to work with HOAs, landowners, public entities within our district, like the city, the county, metro districts, trying to find ways where they can help with seasonal wildland or a chipping crew, essentially, to go in and remove that material. But they're also looking at possibly bringing in something that would also create biochar through like a portable burn trailer.
Basically being able to go on site and leaving the material where you're mitigating.
Exactly.
Yep, that's great. So yeah, large scale and small scale. So that's really wonderful that you both have that to offer the community. And so back to you, Jared, for a moment. Have you had any specific challenges or conditions in the region that kind of really led to wanting to do the biochar facility?
It's simply an overabundance of low value, unmarketable forest materials. The entire thing started as a wildfire program, so how do we get rid of that? Obviously, there's been markets, and there will continue to be, for the higher value material, and please, we don't intend to interrupt those markets whatsoever. Continue to sell them and get the highest and best use of that natural resource. And then what falls through that screen, ultimately, you know, everyone has always been looking for what to do with that material. So this offers that alternative. There was not another viable option that we could identify that could remove that quantity of material at that speed and that scale. So we just want to stay ahead of the next big event. And this is more of a preventive measure as it relates to wildfire mitigation. So,
right. Thank you. You're not open running currently yet. I know for El Paso County, we have the Black Forest slash, is it slash and mulch?
Yeah, the Black Forest slash and mulch program.
Yeah, and I think they're having an abundance issue as well. So your facility, when it does open, are you willing to partner with other counties or other municipalities who wish to come in to bring their materials as well?
Yes, we're obviously up against a capacity situation. We want to help as many people as we can. As we all know, wildfire knows no borders, no boundaries, anything along those lines. It's a regional problem that demands a regional solution. The issue in that is there's a lot of regions around here. And if there's one facility and everybody's going through the same problems, how do we balance what we can produce and what we want to produce? You know, there's obviously a compromise there. We want to process all the liability material we possibly can. The equipment itself is best run continuously, almost 365, 24/7, or close to it. So the more that we can throttle up our capacity and open our doors to as many people that can contribute, the better. But I just can't guarantee that for everybody across the region.
That makes sense. Thank you. And talking about your equipment, what is the kiln that you're using for the biochar facility?
It's a solution through BET. It's a pyrolysis rotating drum. So it's a continuously rotating drum that is fed. The feedstock is fed through the system autonomously, continuously, and produces biochar, you know, every minute that it's working. So yeah, Complete Solutions is our equipment vendor who's helped source all of the feedstock handling equipment, the chippers, grinders, and the pyrolysis unit itself.
So that's the process. So you're actually chipping the material before it would go into the kiln?
Correct.
And I was reading somewhere that you were hoping that this facility will also be a resource for community members for mulch pickups, so not just biochar potentially, but mulch and other resources?
Yes, this is kind of the tip of the spear, if you will. Our intention is to build out an entire waste diversion facility. So we've had a long-standing successful slash mulch program where residents can bring their material. Previously, we've ground that throughout the year, and then we turn that back into mulch for residents' use for free. So we intend to expand these services. We recently added a green waste program, of which we've been composting off-site. So we're obviously going to combine all of these efforts. And my goal from the beginning is to get product back into the hands of residents, let them touch it, feel it, experience it in their own backyards, see the benefits of it, really just educate the masses about the benefits. And then obviously, you know, that's going to start a local circular network, if you will. If all of our residents are using it, then the entire county will benefit ultimately long term. So that's the plan.
So I imagine you're going to have some educational opportunities for the public to come in to learn about these techniques as well.
Yes, that's what I'm most excited about personally. I have a staff member as well. She's passionate about education and outreach. So the thought of giving tours, giving speeches, working with the community, going to where they're at, and having them come into our facility to understand what it is we're doing is what's really driving the two of us as we build this out.
Great, thank you.
Sure.
And for your equipment, Will, so are you using a Ring of Fires, like a small kiln for the...
Yeah, that's the one we're looking at. So it's called the Ring of Fire, but yeah, essentially it's a giant double-walled fire pit, for lack of a better description. So it's very low-tech. It's something that we're working right now on. We're going to hopefully look at getting grants for this, but before that I'm going through the steps with working with our fire district and then the state for trying to make sure we have the right permitting for it, because there's some state rules that are a little quirky when it comes to that, and especially because ours isn't this big industrial unit, which is what a lot of those permits are for. We're trying to figure out where we kind of fit into the picture on that before we start really looking at trying to get the funding for that. But the goal is to, you know, if all goes well, to just have something that we can have in one location where we need the biochar. And for us, that's on our home site, because we operate on about 20 different properties right now. So we would bring the material to our home site, do it there where we have a safe spot, and then eventually we do a lot of composting on site where we take in resources from the community like pine needles and mulches and green waste and manure from horse owners, and then we take that and turn it into a rough compost that we don't have to screen or anything. We just put it on our pastures because we see a tremendous improvement through that. And then if we take this biochar and add that into the composting process, it's kind of taken it to a whole nother step further as far as the abilities for that to hold more moisture. we should see an increase in grass growth, which we're already seeing about a 2 to 3 times biomass increase on our pastures just within a growing season. My hope is that maybe this boosts it to that 3 to 4. But if nothing else, we're taking a good waste product and turning it into something that's going to stay in the soil for a long time as well.
Right, not in the landfill.
Correct.
Where a lot of the material is going now.
Exactly.
Yeah, thank you for that. So, and the reason why you would put in your compost is because when you actually do the biochar production, it's creating very porous material, which is why I was calling it a weathered charcoal. This allows for more microbiota to come in and also more water retention.
Correct. No, you're absolutely right. They'll be considered inoculated at that point, where the nutrients and the microbes exist within the biochar by the time you put it in the soil. There is the potential for raw biochar going into the soil to tie up nutrients that were there naturally. It is so incredibly powerful at absorption, it'll take those nutrients and hold them until the plant can ultimately find them. Whereas if used throughout the composting process, not only does it expedite composting, but in the end you have a premium product that's pre-inoculated that's actually dropping nutrients back into the plants instead of competing with the naturally occurring elements there.
Yeah, exactly. And the other benefit with composting it is most composting processes do have a runoff component to them. And so there's going to be some nutrient leaking from those piles into the surrounding area. And what that biochar really does a good job of is helping capture those loose nutrients and keeping it there in the product. So that way, like Jared said, when you actually go to use it, you're kind of measuring it out to the amount you need based on how much compost you're using and how you spread it out versus it leaching out of the piles and then congregating into one local site where it can actually become quite toxic.
Also, regarding its use through composting, one of the common complaints or drawbacks, certainly probably more perception than reality, is odor coming from composting operations. Biochar is incredible for reducing that, suppressing those odors. The structure of it allows more oxygen flow and reduces the anoxic scenarios that cause those odors. So that'll be another program that we do, is try to reach out to the large equestrian population in our county to talk to them to understand how to work our biochar with their existing manure to create a waste into something that's valuable there for pasture restoration, things along those lines. So all within that circular environment within a single ranch, potentially.
That's a great benefit. Yeah, I've heard about putting it along in your chicken coop as well.
If exactly.
You're like in a smaller area to help with the smell. So it's just many benefits to the land. Why didn't we think about this before? Well, we did, but we forgot about it for a while, didn't we?
And I mean, one of the other challenges too that I think our state specifically has had as well is we've had such a big aversion to anything related to fire, right? So when it comes to processing material into biochar, there's a lot of ways to do it, and some of the most common ways traditionally were open burning, essentially. And we, as a state, have really, up until just a few years ago, really put a squash on anything burning, right? It's only been about 8 years maybe now that the state's been really open to prescribed burning and pile burns and similar methods of biomass removal. But before that, there was a full moratorium on it. And there were some situations where that led to that, where it was done inappropriately and it led to big consequences. But our state's finally getting to the point where it's accepting more and more of these because the need outweighs the old mindset of letting the forest stay as it is, because otherwise our forests just burn down and anything around them gets severely affected.
Right. So these kilns, even the ones that can go into the forest and be built on site, reducing the ability for the fire to really expand further.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I want to move to also talking about another benefit to the land. I think you had mentioned it already, where it enhances the water retaining abilities. So I was reading that Douglas County is now working with golf courses and other entities who are irrigating a lot in our community, and of course with water shortages we're looking at efficient ways that we can hold the water on the land. Do you feel like biochar is a solution for this?
I absolutely do. The more I learn about it, is the more ardent believer that I am in its capacity to fight drought, to maximize the effectiveness of the resources that we're using to sustain golf courses, parks, farms, anything that's growing, anything out of the ground, essentially. I struggle to find situations where biochar wouldn't improve those conditions. I'm actually on a call tomorrow with three of the biggest supporters, very high profile golf courses in Douglas County. They have been early adopters. They've known about the process for years, and they're very excited to have this product available for them to experiment with, to take their trials on a bigger scale to recognize those benefits. So one of the success stories I've heard before is that it has taken a green that has taken significant amount of work, labor hours, water, fertilizers, to keep it in a playable condition. Again, there's very high expectations when you play a high-profile golf course, and it took so much work and so much energy to get this in that state. They injected it one time 2 years ago now, I believe, and it's gone from the worst green of 18 on the course to the best. It requires no supplemental watering, no supplemental maintenance. It's performing better than anything else would on one green one time. So it's success stories like that I think will have our platform with the county to be able to educate the masses, tell them how they did it, how they can replicate that same success in their own backyards. So
that's great. So then I imagine you can move this into the parks department as well. That's another big irrigating place in our region, and even cemeteries. Cemeteries are still even being irrigated.
Exactly. Any place that has sprinkler heads, they're paying money to irrigate. So in terms of ROI, if you just look at that golf course example, for instance, that's an hour a day of somebody's time for 2 years that they're no longer paying. They're doing something else. So the ROI, you know, makes it all that more obvious when there's a maintenance cost associated with an acreage. So that's a big proponent of us, is that educational piece, is to get trial material out into the hands of those that can do the best with it, and to be able to document those success stories. In my mind, it's one soccer field that's treated versus one that isn't, or, you know, a sequence of treatments to really dial in the most effective way to reduce our resource consumption on a recreational facility like that.
And you said you started in 2022 with that project at the golf course?
They did. That was independent of the county, okay. And they're just sharing their success stories and hoping to utilize our resource to really produce a product that would be the most impactful for their specific use. So in that case, it's high nitrogen, phosphorus, and water consumption generally for golf courses. Mm-hmm. So can we create a material based on our feedstock that would address their needs specifically and be able to take a product that currently is fairly generic, biochar? Everybody associates, you know, biochar to mean one thing across the spectrum, when in fact it does not. And we'll have the ability to even hone that in closer to their specific needs. So that's the exciting part for us, is to be able to create that custom golf course blend or custom turf grass blend or whatever those cases may be, based on species, cook time, cook temperature, you know, grind size, those variables right there that we could get it in their hands and give them a product exactly what it is they're looking for.
I think Abe Leading called it the gold in the treasure box.
It's been called lots of things, yeah.
It has the capability to, as you said, hold the nutrients. So it really is going to help eliminate the use of a lot of the fertilizers, which I really appreciate, because that, of course, gets into our waterway system. Mm-hmm. I was reading, too, that I think you were working with Fountain Creek Watershed District and a few other partners in our region, kind of about educating them on the biochar, how it can actually clean the waterways.
Yeah, that's another angle we're going there. So we've made some connections, one of them being at UCCS here in the Springs, that is going to be able to test the amount of nutrients that biochar in a water body can pull out. There have been experiments run, and we're in the process of getting that material tested to say that this went in as pure biochar. It came out as highly inoculated in nitrogen and phosphorus, the exact nutrients, if you will, that become pollutants in the wrong application or the wrong location. So to take something that has become pollution, as is you know, creating a negative impact and reconverting that back into a soil amendment. So it's that, again, circular process that can happen within a property of itself. So the same fertilizers you've been spending thousands of dollars on to keep your grass green become a pollutant, gets pulled out by way of biochar, and then it becomes a fertilizer again. So an inoculated biochar. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, and I think the state, I know golf courses and parks, they are going to have grass for probably years to come, but I really would like to see a lot of residential people and also even maybe even the Parks Department transitioning more into, they say native landscapes, but I really would love to see people grow food, you know, food forests in our region. We're in a food desert here. You cannot eat your lawn. And the state is trying to encourage turf replacement, not ripping it out, but ideally covering it, smothering it, and planting something into it. And I really think that biochar, especially when you do give it back to your residents, it can help them in the process of building soil into their land, because a lot of times, too, when these new subdivisions are built, they're bringing soil in from who knows where, so that it's probably not nutrient-based as you would need. So biochar does offer a nice solution for that. I want to talk about the emissions of biochar, specifically how it can reduce emissions, because normally with the burn pile, we're putting all that carbon dioxide in the air. We're not sequestering the carbon as a biochar would do. So can you talk about the emissions from a facility, a large-scale facility?
I can try. It's probably not my area of expertise, but so the emissions that we expect to get out of this machine and have been documented throughout their prior installations throughout the country is extraordinarily clean, surprisingly. The main output is going to be biochar and heat. The pollutants that you would, or the solids that you would see, typically in a traditional combustion environment, they don't exist here, or they're recaptured within that rotating process. So it's such high temperature and contained within there, the pollutants are essentially vaporized within there and separates from carbon and the heat. So yeah, it's the way that it's processed and then reprocessed, that syngas is recooked, if you will, within that singular piece of equipment.
Okay, thank you. Sure. And on a smaller scale, would you agree that you're getting a low amount of emissions?
Yeah, so even with the less technical style of kiln, the one we're looking at specifically, it's the best thing I can describe it as is if you're familiar with the solo fire pits that people have now.
The smokeless
ones. Yeah, that are smokeless. And the way it works is, you know, you put all the material in the center of it, but it has this gap in between the two walls it has, and at the bottom on the outer wall, it's open, so it allows it to draw up air. And essentially, as the fire is burning, it pulls air up with it, with that heat convection, and that allows it to actually burn way more completely. So not only are, if you're doing it right, you shouldn't be seeing much, if any, smoke at all, but it, like he was saying as well, you're burning off all that syngas as well. And the results of that, especially if it's just wood and there's no other pollutant or no contaminants in there like plastics or something else, you're not going to see a lot of off-gassing of toxic things or even greenhouse gases that are way more potent than carbon dioxide. Another good way to look at this too is on the greater scope of things. When you compare just wood burning in a wildfire, it's extremely incomplete. That's why we see so much smoke come from these events, right? And while I can't say specifically, because I don't know what the numbers would be for a kiln, I have seen research in the past about if you take wood from fire mitigation and use it as a heating source in just a traditional wood burning fireplace, and the difference in that is something around, it's like 50 to 80 fold of difference in the emissions that a wildfire will produce versus burning that completely in that controlled setting. And so it's very similar in a lot of ways when you look at these kilns, is they are not allowing all that off-gassing of particulate matter and uncombusted gases and everything else in between that ends up getting into our atmosphere. And in a lot of cases, you know, with these wildfires, several states over get affected. You know, when you do it on this small, very controlled setting, you're localizing even those impacts to just the immediate area. And it's something that, as when you're looking at a huge scale of things, it's way more beneficial on the emission side.
Yeah, thank you both for that answer. That was great.
You know, something we haven't talked about, I appreciate both you guys being here. This is just great to hear this, because we've been talking about biochar for a quick minute in permaculture. And large scale is definitely something that is a thing. But with permaculture, we try and dance with the fossil fuels. And so moving materials around and grinding them up is a step that on the small scale, which is where permaculture plays in the human scale of things, really has the advantage. And there's many, I mean, we've all seen our forests all over the state are really having a hard time. I mean, we can all see the red trees and then the empty trees. And so it's a very wonderful economic benefit to those who can step up to it. And Pike Peak Permaculture is already looking at that at our professional guild and working on building a hotshot crew for fire mitigation for those places that you can't do it industrially. You can't go in with the big equipment and everything because it's on an angle like this. Still needs to be mitigated. So you're talking about people doing it. And it's like a year-round job, a well-paid job, because this is going to pay for itself in many ways, saving money, you know, as a product. So there's a lot of economy wrapped up in this, and high quality jobs for young people who want to get out in the woods. I mean, I was a young person once, many moons ago, and that's all I ever wanted to do is be out in nature and camp and fish and all this stuff. And so you can't burn all year long, but you have to be in observation all year long. So you have these hotshot teams that take regions. I mean, even very small regions, one side of the mountain. We're talking to Manitou about, can we have just a slice of the creek walk to mitigate to you guys and show you what biochar can do? And so that's something that you guys haven't talked about, but is definitely a real thing of the economy side of it for just the average person. They say a certain percentage of college graduates are underemployed. Well, you know, people want a job because they want to make money. I don't care what career you took in college. If you could have a career where you could be camping, you know, 6 months out of the year, and you can, yeah, I think I would go there rather than into a professional field, if that makes any sense. So I think that's something that maybe you both could address more, but is definitely coming. That is definitely coming. And how many hotshot crews do we need? How many steep peaks do we have? I mean, it's endless. And then after 10, 15 years, you got to do it again.
Exactly.
You got to do it again. But at the same time, we are improving things as we go along. So it's like the little bubbles on the water, they kind of congregate and spread out. And that's my vision. That's my hope for it.
And I can talk to two things about on that topic, too. So from the fire department side of things, this is becoming more and more common of a function of the fire departments, right? It's very similar to how fire departments used to be structure fires, and that was it. And now they're, you know, fire and EMS. That became an essential function. And now mitigation, in a lot of ways, is becoming part of that, too. And that just adds into a whole nother, department of function that they have to, you know, employ people for, because it's usually not the same people that are doing the frontline, you know, emergency response. So like with our agency, we're hiring 7 people for the summer this year, which is a huge step forward from what we've been doing in the past.
It's a new opportunity.
Exactly, right? And while there's probably a dozen or so different agencies along the Front Range that are doing it now, this is becoming more and more common very quickly. And that's something that I foresee most departments in 10, 20, 30 years that are in these wooey environments having to take on, because there's just not enough of it being done. And it becomes a significant safety risk to just leave things as they are. So, you know, on that side, we're going to see a lot more of that, I guarantee, especially as we keep seeing these fires grow bigger and bigger and more destructive every single year. On our farm side, this is where I've seen the biggest benefits, and it's related to the compost, but you know, a lot of farms, especially people getting into agriculture, right, you don't have the funding to go buy a big ranch, right? So most people are starting with small acreages and trying to do what they can with them. And what we've seen just with the compost itself is, like I said, we saw that 2 to 3 times biomass growth of just pasture grasses. And if we can take this biochar, add it into our compost, and improve that even further, right, the cost of doing all that is pretty nominal overall, right? I think at most, if I include paying myself or the equivalent cost of my labor at like $30 an hour, it ends up costing me somewhere around $1,000 to $1,500 per acre to do, which seems like a lot of, up front. But then when you look at the land prices that are in the, you know, somewhere between $20,000 and $60,000 per acre, and then you got to pay taxes and all this other stuff on top of that, that's a huge barrier to entry getting into production agriculture on any size. And so if you can take what land you have and just make it dramatically more productive with a pretty low cost overall, and it's not something that you have to do all at the same time either. You can do it on a small scale and just slowly build off of that. And you're going to see those benefits of being able to do more on the same amount of land. And the biggest reason is because you are just capturing water in that landscape. That's our biggest limiting resource for anything we're trying to grow here. And so if, from a producer standpoint, that's a huge economic benefit to me, to be able to run either more animals on the same amount of land or not have to worry about going out and getting more land.
Sure. That's great.
Yeah, thanks for that. And then we have to think about the economic impact of our fires, too. If we're not mitigating them, we're actually creating more cost. Colorado's most costly fire was the 2021 Marshall Fire. And that caused $2.1 billion in damage. And the direct damages included property damage, infrastructure losses, but there was also indirect damages like medical costs associated with smoke exposure, and then erosion and flooding. So these costs might have been calculated, but they are continued costs because of that degradation to the landscape. So if we can get more people doing this on larger scales, on smaller scales, or actually out there on the landscape, then we can really help prevent these fires. I was reading that the biochar facility would be open for pine beetle-killed forest, so that would be something that you could bring into your facility potentially, and then that would take care of all the larvae, right, in those dead trees?
There is nothing that will survive that pyrolysis unit, that's for sure. Transporting that has been a very hot topic very, very recently at the county, so we're finding protocols a way to, around that to do it wisely as to not proliferate the issue. So, yeah, we're talking through that right now, but, yeah, in theory, the larva would be completely wiped out through that process.
Something else with your point on the fire mitigation side that really ties in well with that is when you start being able to do this as on a larger landscape level, you start seeing a dramatic reduction in those pests as well. I mean, almost every pest we have in the forest, every disease we have in the forest, they are all solved by the same exact thing at the end of the day, and that is thinning out the forest to a healthy level. They are all significant signs of just an unhealthy forest ecosystem. And so the more people and the more places we can do that with, you're going to see the long-term benefits of that just not being as big of an issue. It will never go away fully, obviously, but you know, if we can get to the point where we're not seeing these entire mountainsides just getting wiped out, or huge areas of high-value stuff like landscape trees getting hit, there's going to be huge long-term economic and environmental benefits that are positive with that as well. And then additionally, you know, going back to the cost of those fires, you can start getting a patchwork of properties and land that has been mitigated. These fires can't spread like they do anymore. And then that significantly drops those costs as well.
Right. So finding these areas, mitigating them will actually help prevent further forest fires.
I just had a thought, too, because my insurance kicked up my mortgage by almost $100. It was like $98. My mortgage went up just to cover the insurance because I live in the WUI. So now we got to talk to our insurance companies, go, look, this has been mitigated. I need my money back.
another very hot topic in terms of how to document the mitigation that's occurred and what they're looking for in establishing the standards and then protocols, both public and private, in terms of how to do that, how to create those standards to the point that homeowners can do the right thing for the purposes of wildfire and, you know, reduction in their insurance costs. So something we're looking at currently through the Wildfire Action Collaborative as well.
What would that look like, Jared? Would that be like a certificate that you can,
In my mind,
I don't live in Douglas County, but send me one.
I've heard of a similar program in Boulder, I believe it was, where essentially there's a certification that says you've done this, and there's talk about third party or potentially as a public organization going around and essentially certifying structures or properties as resilient, if you will.
Great. We should find out about that.
There's a researcher from the University of Colorado Boulder. Are you familiar with R. Scott Summers?
No.
He's been conducting research on biochar and trying to educate people on some of these practices. But he was in favor of your facility. He was actually very excited to hear about it.
There's a lot of people that are. We hear from them just about daily from all different angles. And what we've taken away is that there's a lot of people on the sidelines very curious to see if this is a viable means, because it's the same problem up and down the Front Range and throughout the western U.S. is, sure, you've cut down a tree, now what? Can they actually make money on it? Can they actually keep it afloat? Can it sustain itself? Because we're unaware of any other process that does would effectively pay for itself. So this is kind of long-standing, sustainable economically, you know, when we're able to develop those markets, sell that product, bring that money back in to reinvest in the facility itself and to the programs external. So a lot of preemptive, proactive measures I think we can take with the revenue that we generate from the sales of the product. So I think if we can make the money work, I think you'll see a lot more commercially scaled municipal operations. There was obviously a large capital investment from the county. We've determined that was worth it to stay ahead of the wildfire risk. And then, you know, it's been my job looking at it through the tailpipe of the process, trying to find the best ways to, number one, recoup our investment, but also generate that additional revenue to do more good out in the community. So,
and, you know, to build on that, I know a lot of people I've talked to as far as different agencies are keeping an eye on that, because I, for one, would love to see this be replicated. And in most counties, I think, in our state that are heavily forested could replicate this as far as, like, having enough material to process, because it's such a need. I know there's several agencies in Teller County now that are also keeping a close eye on this, because it's a huge issue up there as well. And that's something that if you know, this can be replicated easily, I would really hope, and I'm optimistic, that we will see other operations pop up that are doing very similar things, because the need's there. Like, here in El Paso County, our biggest, you know, issue is there's not enough processing capacity. The slash mulch program in Black Forest is phenomenal, and they are able to process a lot of material, but it's only open for 5 or so months of the year. And then even then, when they're open, they're not processing everything they can. They're usually open for several weeks afterwards, still trying to catch up and finish processing that material. And then at the end of the day, it looks like it's doing a lot, but when you look at the whole entire area, it's like a drop in a bucket. So it's just not enough. And there's no other real good, cost-effective means to do that so far, where people can just bring their material, especially if you got to travel a long ways to do it. You know, it discourages more fire mitigation as well. And we need more of those opportunities for people to do that, because people do want to, once they learn more about the health of their forest and what they need to do, people are eager to do that if they can, and it just, you know, becomes a logistical problem.
Can you talk, Jared, about the funding that kind of led to this biochar facility being championed in?
Again, probably not my level of expertise. I joined the project team after a lot of those conversations had already been figured out. So it's my understanding that a lot of it came through just strictly the timing of our capital improvements projects. So we do tens of millions of dollars a year in capital improvements projects. And the way that I know several came in under budget, and then the rescheduling of a couple, or we were unable to execute those at that specific time, that it freed up funds. So there's a lot of things that fell into place to make this happen, and I think that was one of them, specifically is a surplus of cash that we wouldn't ordinarily have that enabled us to make that initial investment, get the equipment ordered, and, you know, just eliminate that lead time for that, the building of the equipment itself.
Okay, so it got funded, and now you're there for the market creation to help get that funding, the return on investment back, and
I hear
hopefully in a decade.
Yes, there's been a lot of conversation around that. So obviously, the more markets that we have, our current model is based around an agricultural biochar, which I think historically is probably the lowest yield, lowest return on. As we're able to identify additional markets, additional potential uses by way of water filtration, stormwater, wastewater, those type of things. If we can identify those markets to potentially yield a higher value product, then sure. I mean, there's opportunity, I think, to expedite that ROI from the county's perspective.
I see the agricultural lands is like the highest return because we're in such a food desert. But when you think about how many counties we have that are just forested, there's no agriculture up there in ski country. They're going to create all this biochar. And if you get the vision that I get, it's like you have the mountains, and rolling off the mountains is biochar spreading out onto our plains as far east as we can go. Heck, we should give some to Kansas because it's just going to improve our soil. And I mean, I'm talking returns more than money. You know, a surplus of cash sounds great. But we need a surplus of food. Like Allie was saying, we're in a food desert, and if we could get this to farmers without even charging them, because we need the food, and we don't want to be in a battle with our agriculture over the water, which we all know what's going on with the Colorado River right now, the Arkansas River, Nebraska's suing us. I mean, this is an integral part of that if you can get people to really hear. Right. And so I just, that vision of just flooding out of the mountains with all these dead trees out onto the plains and improving things as we go is a beautiful vision.
I like that in watercolor later, Becky.
Yeah, do that in watercolor. Well, that sounds good.
That brings up a really good point, too, of, you know, one of those ROIs is water, right? I mean, we're in such a way right now with, you know, how the water situation is. And, you know, it, like biochar itself holds somewhere around 3 to 4 times its weight in water, if it's, you know, crushed fine and mixed into the soil. And so, you know, on the front end, it's able to dramatically help reduce the amount of water that's even needed in the first place, which obviously gives back to municipal and larger scale water rights holders. So there's a huge, you know, benefit to seeing stuff like this applied in every aspect, from the, you know, smallest garden up to the largest ranch. And then on the other side of it, too, is if you're doing it on a landscape-sized area, you start actually seeing way longer-term benefits of that water cycle starting to improve again. Because we've really done a really bad job of maintaining our soils over the last 150 years.
Right? You think so?
Right? I mean, of the settler accounts right along the Front Range said, you know, we had 2 feet of topsoil when they first moved here, and that could infiltrate a ton of water, literal tons of water, right? And now we're lucky to see, you know, several inches in a lot of properties. And so if you're actually applying amendments like this and compost onto your landscape, what you're doing is you're allowing that water to infiltrate it back into the ground instead of just running off or evaporating. And then that starts to recharge those water tables. All of a sudden, we start seeing creeks be a little more productive. The land becomes more drought resistant. And then we're not seeing these huge fluctuations in our water resources that we are today.
Right. That's my angle coming at it from my current position. Stormwater has been my concern for my career for the last 15 17 years. So that's everything that I see is that ability that Will spoke of compost and biochar together being so ad and absorptive of rainfall. It's keeping everything where it lands. That rain stays where it fell. So these large detention basins, if you will, that you see around to handle flood attenuation, they're there based on their current conditions. However, if we change the upstream conditions to scenarios in which we're reducing runoff by 30 to 80%, if you look at studies, that's 30 to 80% less water flowing downstream. That's 30 to 80% more water that's staying there where it landed. So if you're putting it on your property, you're harvesting rainwater where it lands. It's not necessarily through the gutter system and into a rain barrel. It's literally right there. So you're capturing it there, and it stays there until the plants, get what they need. So
and it keeps our waterways alive. That reminds me of two things. One is stormwater fees. Oh my gosh, beavers. After we get the forest mitigated. Beavers, if you want to solve flooding, we got to bring the beavers back. I just watched another thing about beavers, and I don't know why people are so, including my own family, anti-beavers. Let's get going on this, guys. I'm ready to just jump and go. Let's go.
we're working as fast as we can, that's for sure.
Oh, and two things I said. Mm-hmm. Beavers is one. Beavers are easy. Beavers do it all themselves. The second one is our water laws need to be readdressed, and we're kind of held captive in the web of water lawyers and such. But we all know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but we all know that the water laws do not follow science. And I've heard this in CSU classes of, when they made these laws, there was not a hydrologist in the group. It was during a wet decade. Kind of like the 80s was nice and wet for those of you who were here then. It makes no sense now. The Colorado, I think I'm very hopeful about what's going on with the Colorado River, because that's going to knock down a few doors of, what are we doing growing lettuce in the desert? What are we doing growing alfalfa, high water crop for horses on the other side of the world? Things like that that just really need to be wrestled to the mat and done smartly rather than continuing to perpetuate laws that are, we all know now, don't follow science.
No, and it, actually, even on a more local level, I just learned with the Arkansas River, they're looking at right now being restrictive on who they allow that water for irrigation to go to, back to like 1860 allotments. So, we're at a point now where it's, for years like this, we're hitting this critical mass where something's got to give or it's going to break, right? And I think this is a really good opportunity for the people that traditionally may have had way junior water rights, especially on ag or similar situations, to adapt other processes for capturing that water on their landscape and holding it there as long as it can, right? You can't hold it there forever, obviously, even with good soil amendments and stuff. Eventually, if you have a long drought, you're going to lose it. But you can really increase your resiliency and your ability to still make an income off of whatever crop you're producing. If you can actually improve your soil organic matter and that soil profile to a level that these wet years, you're kind of, it's like a ground reservoir, right? So
that's right.
You can help reduce the need for even irrigation on the front end. And then, at that point, you can actually see, again, those benefits on the long term. Even with our small property, we've spread about 5 acres of compost now, and we've seen it just within our little creek bed behind us. The water table doesn't fluctuate like it used to, So if you get enough landscape areas that are doing this on a large scale, you're going to see water where, we haven't seen it in recent years.
That's right. And that's what's hopeful about all the harshness that we're in right now of, oh my gosh, it's critical mass on deadwood, on the mountains and such. But that's what's hopeful, is that we'll get some positive change in our base laws to, I think if we could cut more curbs and do more smart landscaping on the urban, we wouldn't even need stormwater fees. And Pueblo would like us again. Wouldn't that be nice? I mean, Pueblo, I mean, we're in the tank when, you know, how Pueblo feels about us. We just came back from an event down there. And so anyway, this is all positive, even though it's kind of a scary time.
Unfortunately, it takes this, these extreme circumstances for people to pay attention sometimes.
That's exactly right, Jared. That's exactly right.
I don't get a lot of people rolling their eyes when I talk about drought now. You know, it's very important to everybody. Yeah. And now with water restrictions and usage fees just skyrocketing, then, you know, it's a very easy audience to engage with at this point.
Okay. And the water restrictions sometimes get better results than what people think they need to do. I mean, you know, I've talked to a billion people about their landscapes around here, and, oh, I water every day. It's like, oh, my gosh, you do? You don't need to do that. That's the wrong thing to do. Yeah. Tell them about biochar.
You know, from the fire department side of things, we're seeing it as a fire risk conversation, too. So many people, and we worry about this all the time, is, you know, we get a big fire. A lot of people want to mitigate, and then as that fire kind of fades into memory a little bit, people less and less think about it. And I'll tell you, this year I have not seen, you know, kind of a vigor of people wanting to really be proactive about mitigating their land since basically the Black Forest fire. We're seeing a very similar reaction to post that right now. And so to look at the silver lining of it, you know, I think a lot of people are really wanting to get, make some progress on this, because, you know, we don't want to see our landscapes destroyed, whether it's drought or fire. And, you know, once people have that avenue to do it, you know, they're going to try as best they can, obviously. And so hopefully, we see more projects like this that can help really harbor that in a real successful way.
Okay. It's very hopeful. It's very hopeful.
I'm excited for the biochar facility to open.
Likewise.
For that resource. Talking about the people don't start to see things until there's a problem. Well, I'm going to throw some permaculture lingo out. We say in permaculture, the problem is the solution. And catch and store. So that's catch and store in energy, whether that's nutrients, whether that's water. And the biochar, I feel, has such potential of helping us with our irrigation needs in the Front Range. And I was reading a statistic that it can actually reduce water irrigation needs up to 50%. And I just completed a irrigation audit course in Denver, and learning how inefficient these systems are in our region has really pushed me again to wanting to promote biochar, to promote not watering every day. We need thirsty plants out here. We're in a semi-arid desert, so it doesn't make sense, again, for us to be watering lawns every day.
Yeah, I mean, we keep talking about resiliency, but I mean, just look at it on a specific plant level. Like that's a living organism that needs to be resilient to fluctuations in temperature, climate, drought, things along those lines. And by continually watering it, you're keeping your roots right there. They're spoiled.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We personify our plants. Oh, poor things are thirsty. And then water them every day, and shallow roots. So you said it.
Correct.
People don't get that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Where biochar is going to capture and hold everything, you know, that the nutrients and the water to the point that the plant knows where they're at. Integrated into the soil to the point that the plant is finding it where it is, not waiting for it to come out of a sprinkler head.
Right. And with us, we do have the prior appropriation law, so we're like first in right, first in use. Mm-hmm. But are we being beneficial with the water use on our in our communities right now? No, I don't think so. But I think we're moving into a way that we can, and biochar, I think, is going to be an amazing miracle for the Front Range. Even more powerful than you think, Jared. Going to blow everybody's mind in the state, and I really am excited to see it move forward.
Mm-hmm. That's great to hear. It's very encouraging. That's the best part of my day, is when a phone call comes from somewhere I'm not expecting, an industry, somebody that is passionate about it, and I did not even connect the two, biochar to a certain industry or an application, and to hear what they intend to do with it. And those are the people that I'm actively trying to engage with now, is to, again, to get that product in their hands some way, somehow, if it's at no or low cost, to the point that they can truly maximize its benefits. And then from there, I've got another educator, I've got another raving fan out there. And if ultimately we're attempting to generate revenue to reinvest back in wildfire, then, you know, I've just created another salesperson out there pounding the pavement for me. So that's ultimately the cycle of sales that I'm envisioning. So, yeah, to connect with those people that are currently fascinated by it, that have opportunities that could potentially create their own industries spawned from right around the physical location of this facility. People that can take it right off the line and begin experimenting, developing new products and processes, and just new ways to get it used and back into the ground.
So this is what we're doing here today, too, with the podcast, Bifurcation Method, trying to get it into more people's ears, and then they, of course, talk about it as well. If someone were interested in what you're doing listening today, where would I direct them to speak with you about this or to ask about how they could benefit from biochar as well?
Yeah, our intention is to steer everybody to our website. That'll get revamped and continually updated as we move forward. That's probably one of our most pressing initiatives right now. But currently, you can connect with us. There's an email form you can fill out that'll keep you informed of our updates. There is a biochar email address that comes directly or indirectly to me. So happy to talk to whoever, whenever, just exploring new and better uses of the product and what we can do together.
Great. And I know you had an open house a couple of months ago. I wasn't able to make it, unfortunately. I think you were there, Will. Yeah, it was great. I listened to it online, so thank you for putting that on there. And I'll put the links to that in the show notes if anybody was interested in watching and learning more about the biochar facility. Are there any other open houses or seminars that you have scheduled coming up?
Not currently. There's a lot of interest in seeing the actual facility work, so I'm sure we'll have a grand event when we actually fling the doors open and people can look at it and see it and touch it and all these things. So, I would stay tuned for that. We're very excited. We'll be happy to celebrate it and with anyone that wants to celebrate with us. And we kind of joked. I'm not sure if it was a joke, but I think we might need a full-time tour guide once we're open. Everybody seems to be interested and wants to see it. So, that's, like I said, that's one of the best parts of my job is engaging with the community and educating and promoting its use throughout many different industries.
And I don't believe I asked where the facility is located.
It's in Sedalia, Colorado. It's south of Highlands Ranch, north of Castle Rock on US 85.
All right, great.
Sure.
Thank you. And Will, if anyone wants to connect with you too, since you are doing it on a smaller scale right now for kind of around the Black Forest region, how would they get in touch with you?
The best way to reach out to me is we have a Facebook group or a page that goes over what we're doing on the farm. And usually when I'm doing a lot of these projects, I treat it like a blog. So when we're doing bigger projects, I usually put all that info on there. But our farm page is the Vogel Homestead. And if anyone has any questions, they can always reach out to me on that.
Can we come and pet sheep?
Oh, absolutely. If they let you.
All right, great. And if anybody wants to speak with Becky or myself, you can find us at pikespeakpermaculture.org. And we'd be happy to talk about anything permaculture related.
Always.
Yeah, and we have some, I just want to talk about a couple of things that we have coming up. May 3rd, they're having a Carolyn Baker come down, I believe from Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
Boulder. She's going to be holding a class called Tending Points of Light in the Long Dark. It's going to be a wonderful class. Also, we'll be participating in Meadowgrass Festival this year. And if you haven't been to Meadowgrass Festival, it's a great time, very family-oriented. You can camp there, lots of music, fun vendors, and good time, lots of dancing. No one judges. And then we also have a new exciting venture. We just partnered with Colorado Homeschool Enrichment Program. We are going to be having an Earth School for homeschoolers. This is a tuition-free program that we will be offering on a weekly basis during the school year to teach children how to grow food, make compost, basically how to steward the land as we would hope that they would do in the future. And we're currently raising funding for a living classroom build for this. So if you feel the need to help out with this living classroom, you can go to our donation page on our website. You guys have anything else you wanted to add?
I think I hit all the big parts that I wanted to talk on,
Yeah, you've definitely done your homework. You've definitely been involved in biochar. You definitely know what you're talking about. Every day for me, I'm a little uncomfortable being presented as any form of expert because I am not. I joined the project team because I cared. I was curious. really wanted to be part of a solution, whatever that was, whether it's wildfire and, oh, by the way, it saves the planet too, you know, wonderful.
you say that just, so lightly.
I just don't have, my impacts are less direct on a day-to-day basis. So to see it actually being produced and actually going back into the ground is what really stimulates me and literally keeps me awake at night trying to find new and better ways. So, it's great being in a room with you guys and understanding that it's been around for a long time and you guys have been on the forefront of it and promoting its use forever. It's great to connect with people. There's a win from, like, any realm. Anyone that's right. looking at it can find a victory. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I can tell you, they weren't thinking of the environmental impacts when they said, we're going to do biochar. And that's immediately what I clung to. I don't know wildfire. I know, stormwater. So that's what I gravitated to it, and I just continue to reap those rewards. And then there's other elements that are like, yeah, but can it make money? Well, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
What else do we spend millions of dollars on as a government that doesn't make money? And that's virtually everything else, right?
Pretty much.
It's to solve a problem that exists somewhere in society. This one is solving a problem in society. And by the way, long term, I think it will generate revenue for the county, or for wildfire. So that's the exciting part for me.
Yeah. And it's definitely one of those things that I think this is one of the most bipartisan things I've seen, just people agree on mm-hmm. And when we have such a contentious political environment right now, it's refreshing to see that. So,
yeah, I think one of you said it earlier, wildfires don't stop at county lines.
Nope.
So it's really important that we all work together. And I really am glad to hear that you're very open to helping out the other communities, especially ours here.
That's everything to me, is everybody speaks green ultimately, right? Ultimately, it's yeah, but what's it cost? And in this case, it's easily justifiable. So the money that I'm able to generate, hopefully, through sales of the product, we're going to build a second unit, like sooner rather than later. We're immediately ramping up production. Like, that's already in our mindset, is how do we expand our impacts? How do we take more material out of there? And how do I get more in the ground? And it's that revenue piece that makes the most mm-hmm. sense. It's like, well, yeah, why wouldn't we? We've already proven it ourselves that, we can keep this operation afloat. We can pay for the investment we made. Oh, and the next one is almost pure profit, right?
Yep.
Well, the building's built, the infrastructure's in place. Like, just turn another one on and double production almost immediately.
The need's there for it, I think it was during the open house I kind of chuckled because there's a guy that asked a question. He's like, do you guys think you'll actually be able to put enough material through this thing? And I was like, we could have one of these in every county and not run out of material,
I talked to a guy that was desperate. He just called me out of the blue. You're doing the biochar thing, right? I'm like, yeah. Can you take my material? I'm like, no. Not quite yet, sir. I wish we could. I got 100 truckloads right now that I need to get rid of.
And mm-hmm.
I'm like, he's on a mandate to get it out of the forest by a certain date. And he had no buyer for it, nothing lined up. What he thought he had fell through, and now he's in a time crunch and desperate. So that's been our struggle all along, is getting a concrete number. What can we expect to pull out of those forests, or have the Forest Service pull out and deliver to us? We still don't have a very concrete number, but more and more I talk to out there, like, you will have zero problem. You open your doors, you'll get all the material you want, and then some. So,
and we need more small, local, human scale mm-hmm. mills.
Oh, sure.
Because that guy just needs a mill.
Mm-hmm.
And how many do we have in Colorado?
No, that's
they keep disappearing, right?
They keep disappearing.
Our farm actually got a little sawmill specifically.
Do
for,
you?
For trying to, it's a small, really small bandsaw mill, but it's meant for helping us process some of this material in a way that makes it a higher value for us on the
that's
farm,
right.
you know?
Small is beautiful.
It's not something that, is production level, but if it took off, that might be another avenue. And then, they're all synergistic with each other, because obviously milling wood comes with a waste byproduct as well that, you got to figure out what to do with it. And that's a fantastic way to utilize it, is, using it into mulch or biochar. So
the Pueblo Summit that they just had, the keynote was, and I don't have that, I should have brought it. Their keynote speaker was a small family-owned mill/farm. and what they were doing, and they're doing biochar too, but just, you know, the whole system of these things, once you get them going, they just make so much sense. So that is another opportunity, economic opportunity, on a smaller scale that can benefit, you know, people, just like people in general.
The small scale thing, and I still use the word circularity more than I should, but it's just very circular, and I think it would resonate with the permaculture audience of the cycle begins and ends on that property, right? The vegetation grows, gets processed, biochar back into the ground,
right.
Next generation,
right.
Over and over and over again, right?
Right.
So that's what's really appealing. Like, nothing leaves, nothing's getting trucked away. It's all processed there, kept there. Our scale is slightly bigger.
That's right.
Sure, the county or the region all benefits, but, you know, we're not trucking stuff across the country.
Right, no, yeah, and it's exactly. An imperfect world. There is so much up there.
Oh, sure.
If we didn't have some larger scale, I don't think we'd ever catch up.
Yeah.
No. I think if we started with these, you know, county or multi-county regions, you know, so to speak, of focus, that's still local enough that most people can make that work in a pretty realistic sense.
Yeah. I'd love to partner with you guys, all of your groups. Just to get that product out, when you talk about fundraising, stuff like that, I immediately gravitate towards those type of things. It's people excited, people available. So
we'll promote you. Just let us know when you're having your tour. We'll all show up.
Great.
Yeah, you're not robbing the land. You're not sending it off to landfill. I really love that idea.
Yeah.
And I really do. I love the idea, too, that you're going to be giving biochar back to the people who bring it in so they can bring it back to their land. Because
correct.
A lot of times when we mitigate and we take this material out, there's nothing there to really replenish the land, and that's why they're prone to drying and erosion and such.
Yeah.
I mean, we see that tremendously in our area because so many people want to rake up all the pine needles off their land and haul them off. That's like the biggest thing we ended up taking in when it comes to volume, because we'll have people bring us trailers and trailers and trailers of it. And for me, it's a fantastic resource. But, you know, it's always in the back of my mind thinking, you know, like, man, these people are kind of shooting themselves in the foot a little bit here.
Go to Lowe's and buy a bag of fertilizer after.
You know, and it's funny, too, from wildfire side, because everyone thinks it's, like, the most dangerous fire risk, and it's actually pretty nominal as long as you keep it away from your buildings. And and then you have the water-holding capacity of it that you're removing that has a increase in the fire risk on the backside. But it's... And talking to people, when we use it as a mulch even, it's amazing how many people don't realize that you go to the east side of the country and they sell it at Lowe's, you know, like,
yep.
Like it's in bales that you
North
buy
Carolina,
it.
Everywhere.
Yeah, you know, and so it's funny the mentality we have here specifically that's just so for, like, removing that material and then not really putting back into that same landscape.
Yeah, the takeaway mindset. You know, nature gives us the actual guideline. It says, leave the leaves.
No.
There's a reason it's there.
We have so much turnover in population, specifically here in the Pikes Peak region, and that's a big part of it. I mean, just working with the master gardeners for as long as I did and just trying to get the local council to understand what xeriscape was. You know, and then they chose xeriscapes, you know, people don't understand, so now it's water-wise, you know,
yeah.
And now we have fire-wise, but you spent 4 or 5 years educating these guys, and they get them ready to go, and then they leave, and someone else comes in, and it's like,
exactly.
I just got here from Kansas, and I want my lawn. And
one of the biggest education hurdles that I've found with just, you know, talking about mitigation in general is we get a lot of people that come from, you know, the eastern side of the country, they move here, they see our forests, and that's thick, like where they came from, so naturally to them it's like, oh, this is a normal forest, and the reality is we are very far from what that would have looked like, you know, 300-400 years ago if you'd been able to step into the same environment and see what it was like.
We also have very different soil than they do too, and people are afraid of the acid in the pine needles and stuff, and it's like, no, you don't really have to be afraid of that. But
no, I mean,
fear not.
We don't see any, like I said, we put literal tons of it into our compost making, and we don't see any acidity issues. So
yeah, we use it in lasagna gardening. I mean, there, yeah, I'll take some if you get too many. I'll take some pine needles.
So this is where I imagine a partnership would be great to help with educating even our community of not being afraid of nature and that we can work with it rather than against it.
Yeah, I mean, we all have our own bullhorns, right? Probably targeted at certain segments of the population in this kind of cross-pollinization here of your guys' interests and our interests that collide. And, you know, we can kind of amplify the message in different directions and from somewhere you wouldn't necessarily expect to hear it coming from. So, I like these type of collaborations or free-flowing ideas. Good things can come of them.
And they will. They will.
Thanks, Allie.
Thank you. Gratitude to you both for taking the drive down here to the studio.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, it was great. Great conversation. I appreciate the invite and glad to talk about biochar and happy to see everybody at the facility once we're up and running.
Great, thank you. Thanks for listening to Peak Environment. Be sure to check out all the community podcasts where we are engaging, informing, and connecting people in the Pikes Peak region.